You're listening to the Laugh Factory Podcast Network. For more shows, visit the podcast page at laughfactory.com.
It's the After Laugh, After Laugh. Welcome to the After Laugh, After Laugh, After Laugh. After Laugh, man. Go ahead, pull up a chair.
Hey guys, welcome to the After Laugh. I'm here in my LA yard, my LA location. It's good to be back. But I'm here with an Austin friend, Trevor K or Trevor Kevalo. Yes. How you doing, man?
I'm good, man. How are you?
Good to see you, man. I've been asking you to do this for a while.
Yeah, six months.
Because 6 months I've been asking you.
And
I've
the day.
And I've probably been flaking. Is it been me flaking? Have I been doing the LA thing where I've been flaking?
It's a combination. I've been up to my asshole in work, which is ending soon. So,
what is the work?
I've been running an Irish pub in Toluca Lake that my friend owns for the past 6 months.
What's it called?
Mrs. Robinson's Irish Pub.
So when you're running a pub, what does that mean? It means you're the...
I'm the general manager.
General manager.
And there's
Have you been doing that for a while?
I've been in the bar industry, bar nightlife, about almost 20 years now.
Oh, my God. Wow.
Mixed in with entertainment and corporate America and some other stuff, so, you know, odd jobs and whatnot. So,
Yeah. So you started the bar stuff before you got into comedy, yeah?
Yes. Yeah. Actually, no. The first time I did comedy was in 2000 in Arizona.
Oh, wow.
But I was doing open mics.
Yeah.
So I didn't really consider myself a comic.
So you did the open mics a bit, and then you were like, oh, fuck it. And then you went away.
Then I went back to Chicago. I did Second City. I did open mics there. I dicked around a little bit. Then I started working at a bar outside Chicago.
I think someone's getting shot right outside.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Sounds pretty good.
There's gunplay here. It's freaking LA. What do you expect?
Yeah. Yeah. Then I actually was doing comedy at the bar I worked at when I was like a bouncer. So I was like 26, 7.
So they'd have a comedy show and you just roll up?
No, I would actually open for bands.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, because the staff and the GM knew I was a comedian. I'd done Second City for a couple of years.
Yeah.
So they're like, all right, we'll just have you open up for bands.
I have opened up for a band before. I opened up for Vertical Horizon in the Philippines. That sounds so fucking like, but it was, you know, whatever. It was
does
awful.
Sound pretty cool.
But I've never, one time when I was having a cappuccino in Positano, Italy. But I imagine that is not an easy gig because no one's there to see comedy.
No one wants to see the 27-year-old bouncer that's talking about dick jokes that just got out of jail. And it was like, it was fun. It was definitely an adventure. And they're giving me 10 minutes. And I ended
up, that's a long time.
It's way too much
time.
And
then you introduce the band too?
Yeah. And then I do like this band intro. And there was one show where my parents came, my family came.
Oh, no.
There was 150 people just on the dance floor by the stage.
Holy
and that's
shit.
Not even including all the people in the back end of the bar.
It's a big bar.
Huge place.
Yeah.
And I was telling just dirty dick jokes, hooking up with married women jokes, just all kinds of weird shit.
Yeah.
I wrote out my whole set on paper and like tried to like read off it. I'd been mentored when I first moved here in 2000. Bob Odenkirk mentored me.
Oh, wow. And what does it mean he mentored you? He saw you, he was like, hey, kid.
Yeah.
I can help you out.
Yeah, we're from the same hometown, Naperville, Illinois.
Okay.
Which is right outside Chicago. So his family and my family were friends.
Interesting.
And I told him I met him when I was like 19 or something, 18, 19. Told him I want to move here and pursue the business. And we kept in touch, and I moved here in 2000.
And he was unknown then, obviously.
He was like Mr. Show, SNL than Mr. Show.
Yeah.
You know, Ben Stiller Show. He was more behind the scenes at the time.
Yeah.
Doing a lot of production, writing, directing, some acting as well. I always thought he was hysterical since the first time I saw him. But he, when I say mentor, it's like he talked to me a lot.
Yeah.
You know, he explained to me the business, how to do it, what to do, all this stuff. All these cool little secrets about stuff he's done in the past. He told me, and I'd tell my friends, and now you can read about it 20 years later and like mag or online or whatever.
Yeah,
it's like he told me how the Chris Farley skit with Matt Foley or whatever motivational speaker.
Oh yeah,
that started out at Second City, Chicago.
When they I'm together. Sure.
Yeah. And he told me that, and like when we had dinner out here, and I would tell my friends, like, no way, thinking I'm full of shit. I'm like, no, this is it. Now you can read it anywhere.
Yeah.
You know, he told me one of his ghostwriters was Charlie Kaufman.
Oh,
the like award winning writer. Yeah.
Eternal Sunshine, Spotless Mind. Right?
Yeah. And he. He told all kinds of cool stuff, man. And it was, you know, we stayed in touch for a long time. And then I'd been going back and forth out here for so long. And then we just kind of.
What's weird is, like, when you lose touch with friends who become famous, even though you were close before.
Yeah.
It feels weird to, like, reapproach them.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
It was.
Because it makes you feel like, I know we've been friends for a while, but now I'm reapproaching you. And I'm not doing it just because you're a big star now.
Yeah. It was weird because it was like. He would call me. This was 20 years ago, plus. He would call me to just, like, vent about his day. And here I am, this fucking 22-year-old idiot that doesn't know anything, that's listening to, you know, an idol of mine vent to me about his day.
Yeah.
And then it's like, I look back and I'm like, holy shit, that was cool.
Yeah.
And then when I moved out here officially 7 years ago, I tried to reconnect with him after, like, a year of being here or two.
Yeah.
And I was sending him tweets and stuff, and he would respond. And I was like, hey, I'm at the Comedy Store. I was doing, like, bringer shows at the Comedy Store, like, 6 years ago. And I was like, hey, come by. And I was tweeting all my, like, celebrity friends that were blue checkmark.
Yeah.
And then tagging the Comedy Store so they knew that, like, if they responded, they would know that I'm, like, cool.
Yeah.
You know, because I didn't.
Of course.
I didn't know that. I knew
it's
the
great
game.
Way to do it.
Yeah, I knew the game, but I didn't know the game.
Yeah.
And it was like, and it worked. He responded. He's like, hey, man, can't make it, but has some great sets.
Yeah.
And then the Comedy Store, of course, liked it and retweeted it, like, right away. And I was like, yes!
Can I get some more shows now?
Yeah. I'm like, I'm on your radar.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
What has your journey in comedy been? Because we haven't really talked about this. I mean, the thing that, like, I know that, I guess you're most well-known for, or a lot of people in L.A. know you for, and around the country, is the Dojo of Comedy, which became very, very, very popular in L.A., is one of those rooms. I was always like a Laugh Factory loyalist to my detriment, but I was on the road a lot, but I would always hear about the Dojo of Comedy. And I always knew it was a great room. So, before we get to that, what has been your journey in comedy? Like, when did you find it? When did you kind of go full into it? And when was it sort of like what you decided you wanted to do?
I had the aha moment when I was about 8 or 9.
What?
I think it was 8 years old. Was the 8 years old I saw, I know this, like, it was yesterday. 8 years old, I watched Dynamite Chicken with Richard Pryor with my older brothers. I had 4 older brothers.
Was that
growing
his special?
Up.
It was called Dynamite Chicken. I don't remember.
Yeah, it was like
special.
Sketches and all kinds of crazy
shit.
Okay, so it was
like a variety show.
A lot of ethnic words and stuff, which I didn't know what they were. I didn't know what the N word was at 8. And then a year goes by, and I'm at the movie theater with one of my older brothers. We were going to see, I think it was Pinhead, the guy Pinhead's
Hellraiser.
And I was bored with it, and I walked out the theater to go pee, and, you know, when you could go outside and leave the theater alone and go pee, and now you can't. And I was like 9 years old, and I looked up and I just saw this marquee sign on one of the other theaters that said Raw. And I was like, oh what's that? And I just hear all these people laughing and screaming. And I walk in this movie theater, and I open the doors. It's like you could, like, direct us. It's like literally like a movie.
Yeah, it sounds like a scene in a movie.
Yeah, and I open the movie theater doors. I remember exactly what theater, because I ended up working there like 10 years later as a teenager. And I look in there, and I'm like, and I just see this fucking really cool black guy on stage in like this cool outfit, laughing, saying the N-word.
Yeah,
and all these people laughing in the theater, but there's also people laughing on screen from the theater they shot it at.
Yeah.
So there's two tiers of laughter rolling in at
me. Yeah.
And I'm fascinated. I just was like, in my head, I'm like, I want to do that. That looks like fun. All these people laughing and having a good time in a movie theater. I'm like, this is really cool. Like, I want to do this. Because I came from a...
Do you remember getting the jokes at that age?
No.
Yeah.
No.
You just saw what the effect he had on people.
Yeah. When at a young age, I pranked a lot. I pranked my mom a lot. Crying, pretending I was her, doing all this stuff, and then laughing, and her getting mad, and just give me like a, you know, 80s slap. You know, dad was different. I grew up dark. You know, my dad was incredibly abusive. From when I was about to say,
what is the thing that made you a comic that goes back to your childhood issues?
Abusive father.
It's always something.
Yeah, big family.
Abusive, wanting, like, was he physically. What was his job? Was he just
My dad was an immigrant plumber from Germany.
An immigrant from Germany?
Yeah, my dad,
he
was actually more of a refugee because he grew up during World War II.
Oh, wow.
In Germany, yeah. He actually, his city got bombed. He fled his city twice and then was a refugee, went from Germany to Australia to America.
Okay.
He lost two siblings during the war. that were young. They were twins. And then his parents had another kid. They all moved to Australia. He lost his dad there, pneumonia or something, or diabetes or whatever. And then they moved to America, and he settled in Chicago.
Well, is your dad still around?
No, he died 2.5 years ago.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. So,
do you ever get to talk to him about that? Because that's the experience you never hear about when you talk about the Holocaust, World War II, or Germany. You never hear about the non-Jews who sort of left.
Yeah. That's why this whole Russia-Ukraine thing is like, it makes me sick to my stomach, because there's people like pouring out Russian vodka like that's going to do anything. And it's not all Russians are bad guys.
It's, of course. Of course.
Let's pump the fucking brakes. You know? And, it's just stupid. It's just, typical virtue signaling. They're trying to get something and,
I'm not going to get my butthole waxed by Oksana now. Forget it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I'm going to go to Brazilian.
Oh, yeah. The thing is, my dad was actually, he was half Jew, but he wasn't like, it was bloodline Jew. It wasn't like practicing Jew and all
that.
But
was it the type of thing that he was worried he would get, quote unquote, caught? Did he know at that point?
He actually did get caught, because he contracted polio when he was 2.
Oh, wow.
So if you know anything about Hitler and the Nazis back then, they were experimenting on kids that had genetic defects, or they're just getting rid of them.
Getting rid of them, yeah.
Yeah, so he spent the majority of his first couple of years in hospitals.
Yeah.
And then he was in and out of camps and stuff. I don't think he actually ended up in a concentration camp, but he was in something like it.
Oh, wow.
I would talk to my dad a lot about it, and he would start to talk. And
he would open up about it.
A little bit, and then he'd stop, and he'd put his hand over his face and start crying, and this was up to 80 years old. So
that's crazy.
Yeah, he just couldn't talk about it as much as I thought he could. As he got older, it became harder for him.
Yeah.
I think it also became harder because he just got older.
You know?
So the memories were gone, but
the feeling of how awful. Oh yeah, that's awful.
Yeah. So.
Wow, that's really interesting. So, and one level, he was like a Holocaust survivor.
Yeah, he actually was. Yeah.
Yeah.
They weren't like tagged as Jews, but because he was Protestant they were raised Protestant. His brothers and sisters, but it was like a weird bloodline. Not weird. It's just like a bloodline.
Yeah.
So I joke about being a quarter Jew, and it only happens when I start counting money. And people are like, you can't say that. I'm like, my dad begs to differ.
Yeah, exactly. No, quarter Jew, you have the authority.
Yeah, I'm still there.
If you were 16th, I'd be like, I don't know if that counts. You know the old Louis C.K. bit where he talks about, because his granddad was, or maybe it was his dad. I think it was just his dad, maybe his granddad, anyway, but left Germany during World War II.
Yeah.
And moved to Mexico. And he was Jewish.
Yeah.
But then he put on his thing, like, Catholic.
Yeah, we're cool, right?
That's fascinating. So you were, we were talking about your journey to comedy. Your dad used to be the fuck out of you because he had damage.
Yeah, I tell my friends would be like, oh, my parents spanked me. I go, I wish my dad spanked me. My dad kicks the shit out of me. Like, there's a big difference.
He would kick you and punch you and stuff.
He was a striker.
He was a striker.
Yeah, he was more.
He had a
boxer.
Good stand up game.
Yeah, he was. He had a really wicked hook.
Oh my god.
Yeah, we used to call him Hamburger Patties was his nickname.
Make a fist. You had brothers?
4 older brothers. Younger brother, younger sister.
By the time they got to you, it must have been a little bit softer punches, right?
Yes, it was. I was the very end of it. Because my sister is younger than me. She got her ass kicked once.
Uh-huh.
Not saying she deserved it, but she definitely did some stupid shit as a teenager.
Yeah.
My youngest brother, I don't think nothing ever happened to him.
Oh, right.
Because by that time, it was like, you couldn't
hand
do it.
Sore.
Yeah.
Retired.
Exactly. Retired and knuckles are busted.
That is crazy. Did you ever have a chance to talk to your father about that?
I didn't.
Before he passed? Like, Dad, I love you and I forgive you, but...
But you kind of fucked me up. Yeah.
He never even apologized. Like, I have stuff with my parents like that where my mom was, my mom's a good old Irish woman who liked to drink. And, she would kind of hint towards, like, I know I haven't been the best, but she was a great mom. But that has damage and repercussions from that type of stuff.
It sure does.
But she was a great mom. But we never really delved into it because at a certain point it doesn't really mean anything. But but with your father was for me, for example, when I went to acting school was like you have to confront your family,
yeah,
deal with your childhood issues, and figure out everything. And
I did 2 years of acting out here.
Yeah. With that in mind, did you go to your father and ever try to have like an adult conversation with him?
I was scared for him, not for me.
Yeah.
Because I'd seen how he was when he thought about the war and stuff like that and what he went through. He talked to me about a lot of stuff, but I think he was in such denial for so long that it ate him up. I forgave him in my own way.
Yeah, that's what counts.
I guess in a spiritual way, I forgave him. Because about a year after being out here, 7 years ago, I went back and took care of him for 8 months. I was his living caregiver.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Like round the clock. Like I moved in with my parents. I stayed with them.
Was he able to talk?
Yeah. He was handicapped. He'd been handicapped his whole life, but it just got worse and worse.
Yeah.
He'd had quadruple bypass.
Jesus.
By the time he died, he had like a dozen physical ailments that were just tearing him apart. So. But I had to like bathe him three, four days a week. I had to feed him. I had to check he was diabetic. He got plugged himself. I did write down his blood sugar level, all this stuff.
Now, when you think about your dad's anger and stuff, what do you think it was about? What do you think was the thing that made him? Was it a religious thing, like spare the rod, spoil the child? It was something my dad believed.
Yeah.
Although my dad was never, and particularly I was youngest of three, he never really did much to me. I mean, I wouldn't say he abused me, but he spanked me. But he had a religious belief that spare the rod, spoil the child, which I don't know. I don't believe it, but I don't disbelieve it as much as some people.
You know, I've thought about it a bit, and I just think it was he was angry a lot because he had seven kids. He was basically worked 24/7, 365.
Was your mother Irish Catholic?
Yeah. She was born and raised south side of Chicago. Irish, Hungarian, Catholic, Cherokee as well.
That's pretty dope.
Yeah. But neither my dad drank, but he wasn't like a drunk that you'd see in a movie.
Sure, sure, sure.
Yeah. My mom didn't drink.
Yeah.
It just wasn't her thing.
So the Cherokee part, which is fascinating. Have you ever got to use that to your advantage?
I wish. one of my uncles on my mom's side, who's my godfather, he minored in archaeology, and he was able to trace back our bloodlines. And he had all these projects and did all this shit about our background on that side. And he traced it back to like our Cherokee ancestors were friends with Kit Carson and worked with him and did stuff and whatever the fuck he did. So it was cool, like knowing that there is like information and data that we can look at on our bloodlines back to that. So that was cool.
Because I always heard that if you have any, I don't know what the percentage is, but I think it's like a 16th.
I think it's 16th is where you get
government
funding. If
you have a 16th or more, which Elizabeth Warren definitely doesn't have.
No.
But if you have a 16th or more, what did they say she had? She had like 1/1000. It was something really small.
Tiny fraction.
That's embarrassing.
But she drank like one.
Did she? I don't know. Because of my high cheekbones. Yeah. I was always told, I was like, well, shut up.
And she can't handle her vodka.
Anyway, so I was always told that the government just has like grants.
Yeah.
There's like a book, like an old dusty book you open up, like, just apply for this grant, $10,000, $5,000, whatever it is.
Yeah. And I think you have to prove it somehow, too. If I really worked at it, I'm sure I could find
out.
You
go delve and go back and find.
Cool, give me 10 grand.
So you haven't met any of your Cherokee ancestors in your bloodline now?
No, not that I didn't.
That'd be a whole project. That'd be like a Netflix documentary you'd have to get funding for.
Yeah.
But that's interesting. So your dad and then you saw Raw, and then when was the first time you kind of like made the first steps to get on stage?
Well, when I was in, elementary, junior high, I was doing a lot of skits for school.
Oh, yeah?
Like they would like, you know, they'd
talent shows?
Yeah, tons of talent shows. I think it was sixth, seventh, or eighth grade, I was in every talent show skit. For the grades, and they're like they loved it because I was just like I want to do this. I want to do this when I grow up, kind of thing. So I was like doing everything, and the teachers were like writing the skits, and the kids were doing them. So
teachers were writing the skits.
Yeah, and
I
didn't
remember any of them.
Yeah, one of them was doing an old SNL skit from the 70s called like it was like I forgot what country was that they were bombing. In Vietnam, and it was
God.
I'm like walking through the jungle with a gun, and I'm like forgot what country it was, but it was like shh or something, and it was an old SNL skit, so they could all laugh, and we didn't know what the fuck was happening. So it was stuff like that, and I did. I remember in high school, I did a Archie Bunker. No, I did that in junior high. I did an Archie Bunker skit.
Uh huh.
Yeah, and junior high I did.
So you just took you took lines from All in the Family.
Yeah, and just kind of just you know reciprocated, copied it, and you know it was fun.
Eat it.
Yeah.
What was that her name? Edith.
Edith, yeah. And then I became a jock. And back then, jocks and actors didn't mix.
They did not commingle.
Yeah, it just didn't happen. So
even now, I think that's kind of part of the deal.
Yeah, I to this day.
What type of jock? Football?
Football. I wrestled senior year, and I was indoor and outdoor track and field. I was a shot putter, and back then, believe it or not, I was a sprinter as well.
Whoa, really?
I was very lean. Yeah, I was lean, and I was strong, and I was smart.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was a linebacker and fullback, but linebacker is where I just
you were good.
Yeah, I was really good.
Did you were you honored by the state, no. District or all
I broke my hand my sophomore year and that was it.
Yeah.
And it never really recovered that
track
well.
I was like track, football, and soccer. That was my thing.
Yeah. Then I got into martial arts junior year kind of.
What type of martial arts?
Of school, Hapkido.
Okay.
Hapkido and little bit of judo, and then my friend who I ended up living with for a couple of years, a buddy who's a little bit older, he trained Kuk Sool Won. It's a very unknown Korean martial art.
Uh-huh.
So basically it's all pressure point based.
Yeah.
So it's like that's the whole thing is using pressure points on people to manipulate them and subdue them or whatnot.
Yeah.
So
did you buy it?
I buy it. It was fun.
I mean, I kind of feel like now,
used it in wrestling and it worked.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
interesting.
Because I remember the first match. The guy was I weighed in at like 179. I was wrestling 189. Uh-huh. I was like a catchweight, but he was like over 200.
Oh wow!
And if you know anything about combat sports or wrestling, it's a huge range. This guy was a lot bigger too.
Yeah.
He had a couple inches on me, so. But we clinched up, and I just found the pressure point and just went with my thumb, and his shoulder just dropped. And it's like, if I knew what I was really doing, because wrestling is not a sport you just jump into.
Yeah.
It takes years to develop. If I knew what I was doing, I could have gotten him. But because it happened again, and he just kind of like went limp because I found the pressure point. And he just, doop. But he ended up pinning me the second round. Yeah.
No, because I always think about that, because when you're, I think, maybe we're the same age, I don't know, maybe I'm a little bit older than you, but like, growing up, like all these Bruce Lee movies and martial arts films.
Yeah.
And Asians had this sort of like weird mystical presence. Like if there's, that Asian kid, he knows martial arts. He does karate. He does kung fu. And you were like, don't fuck with that guy. He knows kung fu.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just this mystical thing. And then, UFC came around, the Brazilians came around. And then you realize like, oh no, pretty much wrestling is basically beats everything. There's not a fucking Wing Chun martial art, hand glowy Chinese, whatever the fuck it is, it's all bullshit. Because you get a good old farm fed American wrestler with country boy strength, he will beat the fuck out of Asian dude.
Yeah,
you know
Matt Hughes. Yeah, I remember reading in a magazine in high school. It was Black Belt magazine that 70-something% of street fights end up on the ground.
Oh yeah,
and this was in the 90s, and they're like, how to defend yourself in a street fight, and all I was like. Wrestling.
Yeah.
I was like wrestling or boxing.
Yeah.
Hit someone, knock them out, get rid of it, or wrestle because you clinch and you can kind of subdue people.
Yeah. Yeah. I think for a while, jiu-jitsu was really kind of like dominating mixed martial arts, but now it's like wrestling. Like all the top recruits are the I don't know if you follow NCAA wrestling now.
No. I love watching it, though.
Like Jordan Burroughs and all these guys. I mean, they're like, the number one draft pick for UFC, but a lot of them don't want to do it. A lot of them are kind of like, well, do I really want to get the brain damage that
I wrestled with Charles Martelli.
Charles Martelli?
Who's he? I think he was University of Illinois.
Uh-huh.
He was one of the top wrestlers in the country.
Oh, wow.
He was 152 and I was a 189.
Yeah.
I mean, I walked at like 180, though.
If I had a son, I'd want to get into wrestling. I think it's a great sport for discipline.
It is.
And you started your senior year.
Yeah.
Yeah, so you never really got like
I knew the vomiting. I got into that. A lot of vomiting on. We called it Blue Flag Day, where they just condition you until you
Blue collab. Flag Day?
That was the name of it, because I went to a school. Our colors were orange and blue.
Okay.
And the Blue Flag Day was the conditioning day where that you basically you run until you vomit. And they had buckets out, giant trash cans where you puked into it.
Oh, my God.
So it'd be like four guys just yakking up.
By the way, that's so fucked up that in high schools they're condoning this.
Yeah.
They're okay, totally okay with these kids completely fucking with their
metabolism. Even better, they put newspapers up on the windows so you couldn't see in, for real.
Yeah. It's really messed up that they encourage kids to like lose weight at that age. It's like at the same time, it's also good to have that type of discipline.
Yeah, there's a balance you can find.
Yeah,
you know, and we had a guy, actually a good friend of mine. He wrestled. He was the varsity wrestler in my weight, and he would put on was it plastics or rubbers and into the swimming pool and run around in the swim.
Like Vision Quest?
Yeah, just like that, just to sweat out the water.
Yeah.
We had guys that carried spit cups around all day. We'll just spit into the cup.
Oh, yeah, because what is that about? You lose weight from spitting. Is that the deal?
Yeah, just if you spit all day and you're just basically, you know, starve yourself.
That's so weird. I never understood the whatever the biology everything. Behind there that, you just spit and you lose weight.
There's all these tricks. I remember my coach taught me how to weigh in properly, so you know you can like adjust the weight, the scale, and
pull your balls up while you're standing there, stuff like that.
Shave.
Wow, know, you've got that's a beard. Wild, man.
It's interesting.
So okay, so then did you go to college after that?
No, I went from after I graduated high school. I was a waiter for a little bit. I was terrible.
And, in the Chicago
yeah,
area.
Yeah. And then 6 months later, I stumbled into a corporate job at an entry level. I was a entry level junior recruiter for IT and telecom in 1998.
Wow.
Yeah. Totally different world.
Oh, God.
Yeah. What I ended up in. But I got a taste of the corporate world for years. The cool thing was my owner at the time was a retired musician, like professional musician who toured back in the 60s, and he had a lot of strings out here and taught me a lot of cool things, gave me great advice, but he was a Scientologist.
Oh, shit.
Yeah. I worked for
them.
Did
you dabble?
I dabbled, yes.
How deep did you go down the dabble hole?
I went so deep that on the internet that I quit the company because it freaked me out.
So
I learned about Xenu.
I'm obsessed with Scientology.
I know so much about it. I know lingo.
We could just do the whole thing.
Dude, I know everything. I've sat down with people and coached them on what to look for. Because I have friends that they're, you know, they're whoever it was, their sister, brother, aunt, whatever. They'd call it disconnect. They disconnected from them because they were not Scientologists.
Yes.
And they go 100% into the, you know, the cult religion, whatever you want to call it. So.
So you were a Scientologist at one point.
I don't consider myself one, but I was trained.
It's okay,
by
no
them.
Shame, baby.
I was always. It's kind of like with AA.
You had like one foot in, one foot out.
Yeah, it's just like AA.
Yeah, I get that.
Yeah, I'm just like I'm not sold on it. I grew up
that way. I've been that way with a lot of things in my life.
I'm like that with all the women I've been.
I did. Yeah, I did with the landmark forum and stuff, which is like Scientology light.
Yeah.
I kind of like was dragged into a cake, and I'm kind of like, there's some good, because by the way, some great shit about Scientology.
There's a lot of good
there's
stuff.
There's some, like that first book, Dianetics, which I mean, God forbid I'll ever get through that book, but like,
that's impossible.
Knowing about it and reading some of it, like a lot of the shit and a lot of shit that you see how it's practiced, for example, you look at Tom Cruise.
Yeah.
You look at a guy, even as an actor, just the idea that whenever you're talking, you have to really know the words that you're saying. You have to have full command and appreciation and understanding.
Yeah.
Because a lot of people just talk and they don't know what the fuck they're talking about. And they still like to claim ownership of it. He's like, no, you have to really, if you don't know exactly what it were, look it up. Like, you have to be very specific. And I think it did really help craft a generation of a lot of really good actors out here in LA. You know what I mean?
It's a ton, yeah.
Yeah. So I think there's some great stuff about it. There's discipline and all these great things that are attached to it. But when did you sort of have your falling out with it? When did you? Because you probably right away you didn't know about Xenu from the beginning.
No,
did you?
I didn't. It took my own little research before the internet was really a thing.
Yeah,
but it was still there. I come.
This is '90s then, huh?
Yeah, late '90s, early 2000. I think it was right around after the first time I was out here, I had seen like stuff about it. I'd seen the commercials, and I, you know, my friend that I ended up living with for a couple of years, he was heavy into it. His dad was his dad's best friend.
What level was it? Was he?
He was no, he wasn't clear yet. But his dad was like,
what are the levels again?
So there's clear is when you kind of like hit the first level of coolness. And then there's OT3, OT5, OT7, OT8. OT means operating Thetan.
Yeah.
Which means all your decisions, everything you do comes from a spiritual aspect rather than a mental or physical aspect.
Yeah. So is the top OT9?
I think OT9, but they basically say without saying that you're in it forever. There's no end to the OTs.
Yeah.
You could just continue to develop or create them.
Yeah.
Which is part of the whole pyramid scheme.
Of course. Yeah, well, I mean, it's so funny because when people talk about pyramid schemes too, it's like, I do jiu-jitsu.
Yeah.
It's also a pyramid scheme. Like,
yeah,
the higher up the belt you go, the more you pay in class, the more you pay for your belt promotion,
and you have
and
to
then
like
you get stripes,
and you train people, and
you train people, and you know, they want.
I mean, it's everything's like that to a certain degree, I guess. You know,
yeah,
you think about it, you know, you look back, and you're like, well, everything's kind of has this like pyramid scheme.
And by the way, I call him my master.
Yeah,
my master wants me to bring people to the dojo.
Yeah,
to train jiu-jitsu. So it's similar, but for some reason, because it's physical and not spiritual or mental or psychological, it doesn't have the same weird stigma attached to it. I don't know.
Yeah, that's true.
But I've always been fascinated. I've gone by. I've talked to so many people. I worked with Danny Elfman.
Oh, yeah.
Do you know Danny?
I don't know of. Yeah.
He's married to Jenna Elfman.
Genius, yeah.
Scientologist. Jenna Elfman.
Yeah, both of them.
Both of them are Scientologists. Same thing with Mormons. Like, super nice people.
Yeah.
I haven't met a lot of Scientologists that were just dicks.
Yeah.
Although when you bring up Scientology, they do get a little touchy.
Yeah, they do.
I heard the brunch at the Celebrity Center.
It's one of the best.
It's one of the best brunch in L.A.
Yeah.
He was like, yeah, it is. He got like really weird right away. I'm like, I don't know. I'm not going to say anything else. Like,
yeah, but I think the cover charge is to give them your email and phone number.
Yeah, cover charge.
Because then they don't stop calling you or emailing you ever.
Yeah.
You'd be dead, and they'll be at your grave. Being like, hey, you want to sign up for a class?
So you're living with this guy. He's deep in. Yeah. You're halfway. You're curious. You're checking it out.
I was interested. I'm very interested in everything.
Yeah.
I have a curious mindset, but I also, if it doesn't add up right, I'm not turned
You're
off.
Curious
I'm
just and like, skeptical.
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. That my whole life has been like that.
No.
And that's honestly, that's a lot from my dad because stuff he taught me and told me, you know, growing up and what he saw, what he experienced in Germany and America, the things he went through. So I always kind of go into things with an open mind, which is why I'm very open to conspiracy theories. Doesn't mean I believe them. I'm just interested.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, that's cool.
I'm 100% the same way. I always ask people this when they bring up conspiracy theories. I'm fascinated by conspiracy theories. And by the way, there are many conspiracy theories that are just true.
Yeah.
And the word conspiracy theory, or the phrase conspiracy theory, as I'm sure you know, was something that was promulgated by the U.S. government to get people to stop questioning the JFK assassination. That's how it all came about.
Yeah.
And that's so true. The fact that the phrase has such a negative connotation is just bizarre because all it really means is a theory where more than one person was involved in creating a situation. That's all it means.
Yeah.
It's anything antithetical to a lone gunman or a lone wolf. Like, there was some planning involved.
Yeah.
That's really all it means.
Yeah.
So what are your favorite ones?
Lizard people crack me up.
Sure. Are there some that you kind of feel like, okay, this is real?
Because
I know
UFOs, 100%.
Yeah.
I've talked about this on a number of podcasts. And the late 60s, my dad was, before he got married, he was working in Chicago at Illinois Institute of Technology in Chicago. He was a union plumber, and he got called in on his day off to go fix a gas leak or something.
Uh-huh.
So they brought him in on his day off. It was like a Sunday. He came in. He went downstairs. He just kept going downstairs. Went into in the basement of the building. And he walked into a room, and he said it was about the size of a football field. It's this big underground warehouse.
Yeah.
And there's giant netting, and there is a Flight of the Navigator, like, spaceship just hovering.
Flight of the Navigator. I'm missing that reference.
It's a movie from the 80s.
I never saw it.
Oh, it's a great movie. It's basically the exact same spaceship that Bob Lazar talks about.
Okay.
So my dad.
And this is in Illinois?
This was in Illinois. Well, that's the Illinois Institute of Technology.
So you're saying they had a spaceship in this place?
Yes.
And although when you hear about all the UFO stories, you hear about all the Area 51 and Roswell, you never hear about
Chicago,
Illinois.
No. Yeah. Exactly. Exactly. Makes sense. So he was staring at it, and then he saw three aliens walk out of it.
What the fuck?
For real. My dad.
He's German. He's not going to be lying.
Exactly. Not a creative bone in his body. He couldn't lie if the world depended on it. You know, he'd be like. Ah.
So he said three aliens walked out of it.
Three aliens, like half-sized people. Yeah.
I would ask him 8 million questions.
I did. I have on my other phone, I have like conversations of us talking about it. Because on his 80th, he never talked about it until his 80th birthday.
Holy fuck.
His 80th birthday, he called me. I was out here, you know, doing whatever. And he calls me, and my mom calls me from his phone or whatever. And she's like, your dad wants to talk to you. And I was like, okay. And I'm like, hey, dad. He's like, how you doing? I'm like, good. He's
like, does he have a German accent?
Very.
Yeah.
Yeah, he sounds like Arnold.
Arnold, okay.
And it was like, he just went into it. There was no, like, opening line.
He was like, I got to tell you something. This will shock you.
He's like, so I was working in IIT, and what I saw, I said I'd never tell, and he just went into
it. Did he have to sign, like, an NDA with the company or something?
We were on government watch from then until the day he died.
Whoa. Yeah. How do you know that?
Because, so he would say things. He would leave, like, Easter eggs of information around, and then be like, all right, dad's fucking going fucking apeshit again. He's like, all right, take the wine away. Dad's getting weird.
Yeah.
But it wasn't. He was like, they would call him a couple times a year on his cell phone. My dad had an old shitty flip phone.
Yeah.
Analog. They call him on a cell phone a couple times a year. They'd ask him if he's told anyone. He said no. And they said, okay, keep it that way.
And he told you this on this phone call?
Yes. Okay. I was there a couple times when it happened.
And you were like, what was that phone call, Dad?
Yeah, and he would just say nothing. And he'd clip it and put it down and unmute the TV. And I was just like, I mean, there was a time where it was myself, my sister, her friend, I think somebody else were there. And he's like, no, okay, clip. And they're like, Dad, what was that? He's like, that's them again. And then he used to call it back, and it would be, you know, the disconnected noise.
Yeah.
That would happen. I know our phones are tapped because my brother used to tell me about, if you can tell landlines are tapped, there's like a clicking.
There's a clicking, yeah.
Yeah. I thought it was because he was a drug addict, but it wasn't.
Yeah.
So
you had no idea about any of this UFO stuff until
2.5 years ago. It'll be 3 years July.
And that's when he called.
Yeah. It was
so that
it
must was, have blown your fucking mind.
It was,
and up until that point, did you believe in UFOs? Were you
100%?
Yeah,
I think it's, you know, I've talked to people about it, and I think it's beyond, it's ignorant, and it's almost narcissistic to think that we're the most intelligent species in the solar system that we can't even comprehend how big it is. So when people are like, well, if I don't have I don't have facts in front of me, I'm like, shut the fuck up.
Yeah.
I was like, you can't even see 3 feet in front of you.
Yeah.
Like, you're fucking blind. Like,
it's just, I mean, I also understand the skepticism because, you know, a lot of the story here, like, you know, I was down there by my farm and I saw something flying over the Piggly Wiggly and I thought space critters.
That's the thing. That's usually what it is. It's just some, you know, hillbilly in the middle of nowhere that looks up and sees
shit. Yeah, it's not like a guy like, you know, I was coming out of Paddington and out of my job in the financial institution and I saw this UFO. It's always like a redneck in the woods. Like, what the fuck?
I mean, but you also think, though, like, in a general sense, like nature wise, you're going to see things more in an open area than in a city setting where there's lights everywhere.
But let me ask you this. So what, I guess why I'm skeptical, and I'm still skeptical.
Oh yeah. You should
although be. The government was like, hey guys, guess what? They're around. They're real. Anyway, moving on.
Yeah.
COVID.
COVID. Exactly. So,
but I guess the reason that I'm skeptical is if another planet or race had the technology to travel light years to get to us.
Yeah.
Why would they be so surreptitious about it? Or do you think it's one of those things where these people live, or, you know, this new theory that they're coming out from the ocean?
Mm. Okay.
And then, I don't know if this is Bob Lazar, who maybe was on the Rogan podcast. He was talking about how they don't really travel in the way that we imagine them. They travel on conscious thought.
Yeah.
They travel at the speed of conscious thought, which is different than speed of light or speed of sound. It's a whole different mechanism.
Not, it's It's not linear. It's like,
yeah.
That's kind of just
Is like, I'm like, I get it, like, in a weird sort of like semi, but I don't really understand what the fuck that means.
Yeah. Well, our brains aren't, they're evolved that much more, I'm assuming. Yeah. So it's their, everything to do is on
so what
a
do you
level.
What's your feeling about what's the point of these fuckers?
I always liked, ironically the Scientologists say that they brought us here, but the way they brought us here is like a wacky way. They brought our souls here, our spirits that are inside of us, in these in these B-52 bombers or whatever.
That's where Scientology, when they start talking B-52 bombers, I'm like,
yeah, really? like a giant spaceship has like souls in it that brought us here, and they're like,
it dropped you in volcanoes,
yeah,
right?
In volcanoes, and then you go through the auditing process, which
you
is
were audited,
I was audited a little bit,
yeah.
You go through that process, and then you go through past life regressions, all that shit, and then like your engrams and these things leave your body, these like
the body things, right?
Body things, yeah, BTs, yeah. All this stuff, and it's like, man, this guy should have written for Hollywood. This is really a fucking
crazy
stuff.
Well, I mean,
that's,
he was a science fiction writer, of course.
Exactly. And then there's, you know, there's stories in Scientology that all those books he wrote, L. Ron Hubbard, all the books he wrote were actually his past lives. So all those books were like true about his past lives and stuff.
Wow. They will just, they're like, there's a great quote I heard this year that applies to everything that we've experienced the past couple, 2-3 years. Which is, it's really easy to trick someone into something.
Yeah.
It's really hard to convince something out of something. It's really, to convince someone into a point of view.
Yeah.
But to convince them out of it. So it is pretty easy. Like, they're really smart, intelligent, amazing people who get caught up in Scientology.
All the time.
And all sorts of cults. I mean, every time there's a new cult docuseries on Netflix, I'm like, I'm fucking watching.
Yeah.
Heaven's Gate?
Yeah.
Let me watch. Let me see what's happening.
Yeah.
The Jonestown? Yeah, I want to know.
What about the guy, the Indian Sherpa or whatever he was in, like, Wyoming or something that took over a city?
A wild, wild west.
Something like that. That's awesome. That was fucking fascinating. They took over a town.
Yeah. Because every...
They had enough people to vote.
Yeah.
And they took over this little town.
That's
amazing. And then they just left.
I think cults... Look, I think cults are like liberals. They're like the far left. No, they really are.
The,
like,
far left, yeah.
They're like the far left.
Yeah.
And a lot of progressives. Because
I
think
agree.
They're all really, really well-intended.
Yeah.
And they believe in this idea of a utopia.
Yeah.
And they believe in a communal system of bartering. The problem is human beings can't do that.
Yeah, it's not practical.
It's not possible because it just takes one person in that system to fuck it up.
Yeah.
And usually it's the guy at the top, because when you have that much power, you're going to want to get your dick sucked by everybody.
Exactly. Movie example, The Beach with Leo.
I don't remember that. I mean, it was so many years ago.
That movie made me want to move to Thailand.
I mean, a lot of people, you know, they had to close that beach down.
Yep.
Because so many tourists were fucking it up.
Yeah, after that movie, it fucked it up. They, it was, I mean, in that movie, they basically create this utopia.
Yeah.
Where they live off the land and it's perfect.
It's amazing,
and then,
for like a couple months.
And what happens? Sex.
Yeah.
Sex and power.
Yeah.
Sex, power, and greed, and that's what ruined it.
Yeah. And I think that that's the problem with. And I don't know where we've. You've seen my stuff. I've seen your stuff. Like we both kind of maybe. I feel like you're a little further to the right than me.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
Because I kind of...
So out here, I'm a hardcore right-winger, which is weird.
And Austin, you're moderate.
Yeah. Yeah. Anywhere else, I'm moderate.
Yeah, yeah.
But here, it's just like, he's the devil. But you know, I've noticed a lot of that surfacing out here. I noticed during COVID, if you see blue check marks not tweeting or talking about it, you know where they stand. Because they're not talking about it.
Of course. Of course.
And it's like, pay attention to what's not being said.
I have a lot of... I'm kind of jealous of those people, like my buddy Jake Shields. Do you know Jake Shields?
Dude, hell yeah. I worked in the MMA industry for like 10 years.
Yeah. Well, I mean,
know him back in the
I
day.
Never trained with him.
Okay.
But at Henzo Gracie's in New York, shout out to Henzo. I trained with John Donaher and all those fucking guys, Gordon Ryan, Gary Tonin, and Jake. And like those guys wouldn't fuck with me, but Jake would come see my comedy shows.
Yeah.
So Jake would see my comedy shows and come back and tell Gordon, Gary, and John, like, this guy's so fucking funny. I saw him fucking headline at Caroline's. And they were like, this fucking blue belt over here? So I had like the respect of the dogs there because of Jake. But he'll just really unapologetically just trash.
Yeah.
And I'm definitely not there. Like, I definitely don't feel... I feel that I, as a cisgendered white man, I have a responsibility to kind of get out of my ego and get out of my own, and kind of be like, okay, if someone is trans and they're this and that and they're feeling like I have to be as empathetic and sympathetic as possible for them. You know what I mean? I do feel that way, and I do feel that I'm not mad at liberals and progressives for some shit where I feel like you're just fucking wrong.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, sometimes although I was watching Bill Maher the other day, and there's this woman on, I was like, shut the... Like, everything she said was just like... She's like, you know, COVID.
Oh, it's over.
And then Bill Maher goes, well, do you realize that 80% of everyone who was hospitalized was obese? She goes, well, I don't know the numbers on that. And he was like, you know all these other bullshit numbers, but you don't know the most important numbers about COVID? Anyway, I think that's where a lot of people, and particularly comics, kind of... sort of changed a lot, their ideology a little bit.
It did, yeah. I saw a lot of comics. I had, you know, personal or intimate conversations with some comics that really were just kind of like, you know, on the fence moderates. And then they saw how this became a total political money grab. And I saw them change, and now they're open about it.
Yeah.
And I'm glad, because it's like, you know, Rick Overton. Brilliant, brilliant comic and actor.
Yeah.
You know, he's we became really good friends years ago when the Jimmy Dore Show used to do the Dojo Comedy.
I mean, he's a Hollywood writer and, and actor, and he's in it.
And he's more like anarchist. You know, he just says fuck it all. But he, you know, he said something to me when I came back to LA from Austin. He was like, he goes, now's the time to just say what you want and quit hiding and be who you are.
Yeah.
Like, in that sense of, say it, fuck it, you know, like, you're going to earn the respect of people more rather than trying to, like, curtail to, you know, somebody that, you know, you want to guest spot on. I always say guest spot on a TV show.
I
sent a tweet out the other day. I'm like, it's been a while since I kissed ass in Hollywood. who do I need to like and retweet to get a guest spot on their series? Because it's like, I see people doing that, and I'm like, you're not going to get it that way. You still have to audition. You
know? Yeah, of course. I have to admit, like, I completely... But I also... I'm not going to say everything that I really feel. Particularly on Twitter.
Yeah, Jesus. It's a nightmare.
I mean, you know, there's an idea. Say it, forget it. Right, regret it, you know?
Yeah.
So I feel like even a podcast can come back and bite you in the ass.
Yeah.
But someone has to take it. They have to grab the audio. They have to then post the audio. You know what I mean?
It's a lot of work.
It's a lot of work.
A lot of work.
You have to have a really motivated stalker.
Yeah.
But a retweet, someone who's just like, screenshot, look at this motherfucker.
Yeah.
You know? So sometimes I'll tweet something. I'll go, I should fucking do delete this. And it's never anything that bad. And you know, 99% of the time, it's just me trying to make light or make a joke about something.
Yeah.
Like I even tweeted, I said, I'm all for trans rights. I don't know if you saw this one, cause I know we follow each other on Twitter, but the Disney Plus now has a parental control setting for, puberty blockers, which seems a little extreme.
Yeah.
I was stoned as fuck when I wrote it. It wasn't like, you know, I don't think it's a great joke, but not a bad joke.
Yeah.
Parental controls.
It's a Disney smart Plus. Joke.
Are you with me, Carnegie Hall?
Yeah.
And then, this woman responded. She said, yeah, maybe, or something like, well, maybe these people just don't want to have miserable lives where they go through a puberty they don't want, and they live, and they're horrible and depressed and da 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 da. And then I wrote back, are you talking about, are you pro medical transition for children or anti? Because it sounds like the same argument to me.
Yeah.
And then she deleted her tweet.
Yeah.
And of course, has my lowest followings on Twitter, so I don't want to lose followers. So I said, I said, I pissed you off. What happened? And she told me she's trans, and I didn't know that.
Yeah,
she's a comic. She's in England, and she said she's trans. And we had like a kind of a back and forth.
Yeah,
about the trans stuff. And it's funny because, and I'm not complaining about this. I definitely had to take the role of like, I hear you.
Yeah,
I get it. I'll read this. I'll da da da. But when I offer my opinion about something, and you know, my opinion having a daughter and stuff like that is basically like, at least it's okay to question what the fuck is being taught our kids.
It's absolutely,
you know,
Absolutely.
The Florida bill, which I understand why it's a little nebulous. Maybe it should be written better. Maybe there's some parts of it that are okay. Maybe there are kids who don't have supportive parents and they need someone else to talk to. I understand that. I understand. But in general, the idea of transparency for kids to know that transparency for parents to know that their kids are being called different genders in school and that they should be like, I think that's look, as a parent, I don't have a problem with that. Really? At the very least I get it.
Yeah.
And even when I brought up the idea, it's like, let's just, you know, the transition that is really being criticized by a lot of people who are politically neutral is not boys to girls. It's girls to boys because it's happening in a rate that far exceeds anything that'd be predicted by the DSM. It's like 4,000% in some communities.
Wow.
A 4,000% jump of kids girls that identify as boys or wanting to transition boys.
Yeah.
That's not just, oh, now we're free to be ourselves. That's a social contagion.
Yeah.
And so I mentioned social contagion to her. I said, because she was male to female. I said, it doesn't necessarily apply to what you went through, which sounds like true gender dysphoria, but there does seem to be an element of social contagion that's being like promulgated by like TikTok and YouTube and social media. Yeah, that's like, look how cool it is to do this.
Exactly.
And you get some like social, what's the word I'm looking for? Social cred or social value. I'm not saying the right word, but and when you're a kid at that age, I mean, I was a fucking asshole. I didn't know shit. I would have done anything to be cool. I was the biggest dork on the fucking planet. I had horrible acne. My dad would cut my hair with a bowl, literally.
Yeah.
I didn't have fucking money. All my clothes were like, people say bowl cuts are literal.
They call that the Virginia cut.
So like, if they were like, hey, guess what? If you just say, if you wear a dress and say you're a girl, like everyone's going to think you're fucking cool.
Yeah.
I was retarded. I would literally go in the backyard, look for spiders to bite me so I could become Spider-Man when I was 10.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Kids are stupid. Yeah. They're fucking retarded.
We believe in Santa. We believe in God. We believe in Jesus. We believe in Xenu.
So to give them that ability is pretty fucking, it's a dicey one. At the very least, like, there should be an allowable dialogue about it. That's all I'm saying.
I think I agree with 100%. I think it's just, to me, my best friend back in Chicago is a school teacher. My roommate here is a school teacher.
Oh, wow.
And my best friend in Chicago, he's a Mexican dude, you know, kind of from the sticks a little bit, way outside Chicago. But he's a democratic liberal that does not believe in it at all.
Yeah.
He goes, we should not be teaching children about what they like gender wise and this stuff. He's like, it's not the focal point. And I was just like, I want to know, like, cause I don't have kids, you know, and that's always something that, you know, you talk to someone with kids and you don't have kids, you don't understand. And I'm like, well, I was a kid.
Yeah.
I do understand.
Yeah.
The thing was, I didn't battle with my sexuality as a teenager.
I didn't know anything about it when I was in elementary school.
Because it wasn't being forced down my fucking throat.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, I was like, it's not, it wasn't a thing. It wasn't a trendy thing. It wasn't a TikTok thing.
No one knew about teachers' personal lives at all.
No, I don't want to know what my teacher, if they're, you know, a drunk, if they're bi, if they're gay, if they're, you know, like to get pegged. It's like, I don't give a shit.
Are they multiple orgasmic? Yeah, is she a squirter? My second grade teacher?
Yeah, I'm like, just, you know, I sent out a tweet, you know, last week. I said, you know, I'm glad my parents didn't teach me about sex at 5. Or my teachers, or my four older brothers. Just let me shit my pants in peace. I'm 5. I don't want to know about that. No one should know about that.
Yeah.
If a kid's like asking, it's just like, okay, well, you know, when you're a boy, you're born a boy and you're born a girl. And then if you feel a different way, then, you know, let me know in 15 years because it could be a phase. How many phases do we go through as children?
Yeah.
Dozens, hundreds, well, maybe.
That's where we're at now.
I wanted to play professional football.
Oh my
Look
God!
At me.
Everything that I wanted to do, I wanted to. Yeah, I'd be a.
I wanted to be a comic when I grew up. Look at me! I can't even get booked at Vulcan.
Oh my God!
I love Vulcan though. But you know what I mean? It's like,
well, I think I think there's something with the gender identification and the COVID stuff that's very similar. And again, I don't think it's coming out of like malintent. I think these people really believe that they're helping. Like, I think that everything with Fauci, as much as people shit on Fauci and some people are like, he should go to jail. Like, shut up. He shouldn't go to jail. He's just some old fuck doing his job. But like, I do think that in his zealousness to make sure there was no vaccine hesitancy, they really went hard against anything that could be therapeutic against COVID or anything that was prophylactic or anything, ivermectin, hydroxychloroquine, anything.
Vitamins.
Vitamins, zinc,
exercise,
D,
water,
anything,
sun.
Losing weight, anything that could.
Dude, yeah.
Like, they just wanted to, they thought anything that they pushed too hard that direction could create vaccine. And if they really believed that the only way out of it, and by the way, Fauci thought that was the case with AIDS. He thought that we'd get out of AIDS with the vaccine, which we never got. So he was 100% wrong. But he felt that way with this virus. That was his point of view. He tried to do his best. He probably suppressed a lot of shit because of it.
Yeah.
And a lot of it was probably some bad choices. But I don't think he did it out of like twisting the handlebar mustache, evil malintent. He thought this is the best way to cure it. I think he was probably wrong in the end. We'll see. But so I think same thing with the like these people who are really all for, you know, don't say gay bill and everything like that. Like, I think in their hearts, they're coming from a good place. They're like, we don't want kids to kill themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And they're being told by the media, by Pete Buttigieg, that kids are going to kill themselves. So they don't have an outlet for someone to talk to because if they go home to their redneck, white trash Florida parents, they're just going to beat the fuck out of them.
Yeah.
And you know what? They're, I'm sure there is truth of that
there
in some
is,
cases.
Yeah, there's definitely truth to it. Yeah.
But the point is, it's worth the dialogue, it's worth a case-by-case situation. It's not just like evil Republican Florida fucks and us at the I mean the good thing about the slap is I think it, at the very least it exposed that Hollywood doesn't have the moral high ground in anything anymore.
Yeah.
Anything. That's, they can't say shit about anything.
COVID exposed the truth in Hollywood.
COVID exposed and that, even that slap, the fact that they gave him a standing ovation after he assaulted another man on stage. That's so fucked up, dude. It's so fucked up.
Yeah.
I can't even.
And what did he get? A 10-year ban from the Oscars?
Ooh. Doesn't mean he can't get nominated.
Exactly.
Just means he can't go to a shitty event.
Yeah.
That people really don't want to go to anyway, apparently. So anyway. But so I think, like, I always try to look at people with good intentions, that they're coming from a good place. Oh, I got to take this real quick. This is someone's checking out my place because they want to rent it for Airbnb. Hello? Okay, can you give me 10 more minutes?
Oh, sure.
Okay, thank you. I'm in, there's a lot back here at 1510. You can park behind the Laugh Factory. It's all free.
Okay.
Thank you. All right. So, sorry about that. So let's segue. That's perfect. Give us a chance to segue. So we're going off the fucking rail. So you were an LA guy. So how did Dojo Comedy come about? How did that become like a sort of like iconic LA comedy spot for a while?
So I was the manager at Sycamore Tavern. I'd been working there on and off. I was a busboy. I was a server. I was a floor manager. And then,
you're just a worker. You like to work. You're a hard worker.
It's that fucking immigrant blood.
That German Irish fucking.
It is, man.
Yeah.
It's just, I enjoy working, but I also realize through sobriety that I need to take time not to work so much.
So when did you become sober, by the way?
4 years ago, February 28th was my sobriety birthday.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
And that's very recent. And I'm always very fascinated by sobriety and people who in the program. I myself have not been in the program, but I'm from Irish, you know, Angela's Ashes was like my family history basically. Yeah. And, because of that, I think I developed an allergic reaction to alcohol, to wood liquors and stuff because my mom drank so much. And I think that like, because of that, I'm drawn to people who have that issue.
Yeah.
I can't tell you the girls I've dated in AA, how many chip ceremonies I've been to. It's fucking bananas.
Yeah.
So for you, like, what was the moment that made you kind of like...
I got stabbed. I got attacked.
Holy fuck.
Yeah, San Diego, right by the carotid artery, right here, quarter inch away. I was drunk, coked up, and stoned. Oh. I went down there to just get away from LA, and LA found me, basically. Well, not LA, but you know what I mean.
How'd that happen?
I was partying with my buddy. He went inside a Denny's to take a piss.
Were you like, what part of San Diego?
I was in PB, Pacific Beach.
Which is not like a rough neighborhood,
there's
really.
There's one area that's just dumpy. And dumpy. It was right by a Denny's. And I was in the parking lot. I was fucked up. I was standing outside of his truck. He's got a real nice truck. And then someone came up from behind me and like...
So I had nothing to do. There was a fight. It's just
nothing.
Like random...
I wasn't drunk, talking shit, nothing, dude. I was chill all day. They said it was, they thought I was somebody else, but They didn't rob me. They didn't jump me. And after that, they just stabbed me. I had a blood transfusion, emergency surgery. I got rushed to the hospital.
What was emergency surgery on?
Because I bled out so much.
They'd replace like an artery or something?
Oh, it was just they thought that they cut the artery, the carotid, because I bled out so much because it took about 20 minutes to get to the hospital. So by the time they got there, they thought that there was blood. But then when they put me under, they found out that the artery didn't get hit. But I bled so much, I had to have, blood transfusion, all that shit. The next day, the nurses said that they're not sure, but they think that they said they had a couple incidents where it was gang initiations.
Oh, shit.
So it's like kill someone, get in the gang.
That's what it sounds like.
Yeah, so that was – I came to terms with it, but they never caught the person, so to speak. The cops or detectives, dude. When I came to after surgery,
so you were out for how long?
I think I went in around 8 or 10. I was out by I think the sun was still down. So 6 hours, 8 hours, maybe.
Yeah, it's kind of like a mini coma.
Yeah, and I came to, and I thought I was dead. Like came out of it, my eyes. I was like, "What the fuck?"
Yeah,
because there's all these people in the room, and I'm just sitting there, and I started like feeling my fingertips, and I could feel it. I was like, "Okay, I think I'm alive."
Yeah,
because I heard places that if you can't feel anything in a dream physically, then it's a dream. So I'm like feeling my fingertips, and I'm looking around, and my eyes, and there's surgeons, nurses, and detectives in this room, and within 2 minutes, they're just questioning me, just on me, and I just didn't. Dude, that just came out of surgery.
So I'm assuming they thought that you were part of some sort of something that happened.
Yeah, exactly. And then they said a couple of the nurses thought that's what it was. I never got confirmation.
Wild. But you have no idea what the guy looked like, anything.
Nothing. Just, dude, it could have been a guy, girl, black, white, Latin, Asian. I don't know. And it was because I was fucked up too.
Yeah.
I mean, I was fucked up. But the coke, like, somehow kept me, like,
saved your life.
It did, yeah. Because when I was in the ER room, you know, they stripped me down. There's all these people screaming, all this stuff, just like a fucking TV show or movie, just like that. And I was soaked in blood. I lost 2 pints, man.
Wow.
I think your body has 5 pints.
Holy shit!
Almost half my blood was gone.
Good lord. So that's an NDE.
Yeah,
that's a near death experience. Yeah. Right there. Yeah.
The surgeon told me when I got out of surgery, he came in to check on me. He's like, and he said, he goes, "How you feeling?" Da, da, da. And I'm like, "I'm tired, whatever." And he's just out of it. And I was just mentally and emotionally just a child.
Wow.
And I just didn't know what to think or feel. And he's like, "Well," he's like, "a quarter inch from the carotid artery." He goes, "That's as close as it gets to dying. Glad you're alive." And he tapped me on the shoulder. He's like, and he walked away. And I just sat there for about 30 seconds and just started bawling my eyes out. I just kept all this in and just let it out. Like, I'm alive. And it was like, was like day one for me.
Yeah.
You know? And I was like, all right, what am I
doing? And so right there, something your brain said, I need to be sober.
Yeah.
Because at the very least, like, you would have been more aware of your surroundings. Yeah.
I don't ever want to be in that situation again, which is why I do things a certain way. Why I sit certain places. Why I look at things a certain way. If I hear something, I'm not like ADD. I'm like.
Yeah.
I was at a Rogan show at Vulcan last year, and it was 300 people in there. And I started to get tunnel vision, and just my anxiety just went whoosh, and I fucking walked out the door, walked to my car, got in my car, and just started breathing.
Yeah.
I just like this, and that doesn't happen a lot.
Yeah.
It happened to me twice at this bar job I'm at, and I was like, I can't do this. You know, it's unhealthy.
Yeah.
Certain situations, I just can't be in it. It's
wow. And it's all because of that moment. Yeah,
PTSD.
Yeah.
Before that, no problem.
Yeah.
Because, you know, if I was dealing with something, I could just rip a shot and I'm fine.
Yeah.
That was my thing. I was like, rip a shot.
Yeah.
Good. Rip a shot. Have a drink. That's just the life I lived for so long. Yeah. Now it's like, deal with it.
Yeah.
No ripping shots. No.
You have no temptation for any substances, any
down the road. And ironically, I talk about this in my sets. Mushrooms help me with that.
You know what's so funny about that is I'm a huge fan of mushrooms recently as an adult, and I was like guided into mushrooms. So my mushrooms were like, "Hey man, fucking do some drugs, do some mushrooms." Mushrooms were like were like my way of meditating and communing with nature and understanding myself. So it was always very, very, very intentional.
Yeah.
I didn't fuck around with it. And I've, since then, I've guided people on mushroom trips.
Yeah.
I tell people. But a lot of people who are have issues with pills and drinking, they're like, oh, no, I don't do drugs. I'm like, no, bro. Mushrooms is not drugs.
It's not. If you abuse anything, it's going to mess you up.
But even mushrooms, like
mushrooms,
the way people abuse it is they abuse it because they do it with coke, they drink with it, and they do other shit with it, you know.
Or they take way too much.
Yeah,
they
just like gobble, gobble. They don't have any intention behind it. Yeah.
Right. And that's, it was a year and a half after I got clean is when I started microdosing.
Oh, wow.
And it's I don't want to say.
You still microdose every day?
Not every day.
Yeah.
Now it's not nearly as much as I was.
Yeah.
For a while, I was kind of doing a little too much and having fun with it.
Yeah.
But it was always at a very small level, but it was making me feel good.
Sure.
And not like in a numbing my pain. It was more of like feeling my pain and coming to terms with that and knowing I'm not a bad person.
I don't feel like
forgiving
myself. Yeah, exactly. I don't feel like mushrooms really numb your pain. Mushrooms make you confront a lot of shit.
It absolutely did. Yeah. And I would take it and go do something and, you know, be a part of nature and do stuff. For a while, I would take it, like, after work when I was out here, and I go to, like, a bar. I go to Barney's, have a non-alcoholic beer, hang out. But now it's like, if I take it, I take it just as medicine, I call it, you know, to fix myself.
Exactly.
Fix what I broke.
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
That's amazing.
It's helped me a lot.
Yeah, know. For sure. Do you deeper than psychedelics? Do the LSD and the ayahuasca?
No, I would consider it down the road, but ayahuasca scares me.
Yeah, I know.
That whole process.
It scares me too, which is why I kind of want to do it.
Yeah, that's the other thing.
Because I'm so terrified, I'm like, I should do it.
Yeah. It's kind of like skydiving.
And like puking, like, oh, but you puke. Ah, puking's fine.
Yeah.
I puke all the time. So, I know we don't have much more time, which is a bummer, but the Dojo of Comedy, so after that happened, you started it when?
Yeah, I started it, it was like 5 years ago.
5 years ago.
It was
so
about,
before this happened?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I started it, I was doing comedy there when I was at Sycamore Tavern. Guy named TK, he used to do Rebels of Comedy, he was a bringer show guy.
Yeah.
He was doing shows there, I was doing shows there, then I started doing his shows, and then he did a show with Sam Tripoli there, they like did a combination show. And Sam loved the room, and Sam and I like had talked a little bit, and I ran into him at the Comedy Store one night, and he's like, hey, he's like, I love your room. I have an idea. I'd like to do some stuff with you. And I was like, cool. And then one day, they fired the general manager of the bar, and they moved me up to like a full-time manager. And the owners were like, what do you want to do with the room? And I said, I'm a comedian. I moved here to do comedy. They're like, just make it a comedy room. We don't care.
Yeah.
Just do whatever you want to do. Do what you need to do.
Yeah.
Literally gave me 100% free reign.
Wow, that's God, how rare is that?
Yeah, it's once in a lifetime opportunity.
Yeah.
And I sat on it for a while and I was like, man, I think I can do this.
Yeah.
On my own. I didn't bring anyone aboard yet. Then I called Sam the next day. I was like, hey, dude, I got the room. He's like, holy fucking shit. And he went crazy. And we started, you know, building shows, doing things. And 2 years in, I was running 4 shows a night, 6 nights a week.
Holy shit.
Opened up a
4 shows a night every 6 nights a week?
6 nights a week.
So 24 shows a week.
Yep, and I was getting on all of them.
And were they
I was getting up 24 times a week on average. That's on the low end.
And were the crowds always like full?
Anywhere from, well, I would do 1 to 2 mics in a small room.
Got it.
Because I opened up a second room on the main floor. Upstairs was like the main room kind of. The downstairs room was more of a mic, small showroom. And the downstairs room would either have a mic and a book show or 2 mics.
Yeah.
Upstairs, only book shows, no mics.
Yeah.
So I was getting up, like I said, 24 times, you know, and I was a machine. It was great. But I was also running the shows, producing everything, putting everything together.
Yeah.
All the back end stuff. And on top of that, running the restaurant. Keeping that place afloat, building that.
Yeah.
I was doing private parties, private events, mixers, birthday parties.
But you were loving it too.
It was fucking amazing.
Yeah.
And I never let my ego get in front of me.
Sure.
I put comedy, I put people, I put comics, I put that club in front of me all the time.
Yeah.
Because I would only do 5-minute spots in my own club.
Did it just go away with the pandemic? Is that what happened?
COVID killed us.
So COVID killed it.
March 14th, 2020.
And the place doesn't exist.
It's still, well, the building's still there. It's for sale.
The building's there, but
the building's
bar
there.
Is gone.
Yeah. The building's there. It's for sale or for lease. But, you know, I made peace with it. I
buried
so
it.
So you never thought, like, God, can I get some people together, do a GoFundMe, try to buy it, make it
I would
happen.
Love to, but they want like, $15 million for the property.
Jesus
and they want, like,
Christ.
$40,000 a month for the lease. So,
fucking hell,
and
really?
And it needs a shitload of TLC. Well, the lot's enormous. It's worth a shitload.
Yeah, yeah.
It's
wow,
property,
that's crazy.
So.
Man. And that's when you moved to Austin.
Yeah, then I moved to Austin later that year. Yeah. I took that first 6 months, did a lot of traveling. I was doing shows in other states. I was just getting out.
Yeah.
And then I moved to Austin that following October and was in Austin for a full year.
Wow.
And did comedy. And I loved it, man. I loved,
loved
it because I got to
we
do comedy.
Met the Green Jay there in Austin. And I got to tell you, Green Jay was cool because it was a tough room.
Yeah.
Which is good. Tough rooms are good.
Yeah.
Don't let comics tell you otherwise. Any room that's hard to get laughs is a room you should get up on.
Yep. people trash the room. And they didn't say who. Like Jamie Kennedy came into town and he goes, I heard it's a bar show. I go, it's in a bar, but it's also technically a music venue.
Yeah.
That's what it's labeled as. He goes, well, I heard it's a bar show. And I'm like, you're going to love the room, dude. When he came into town, he's like, holy shit, this room's beautiful.
Yeah, it's great.
It's a great room. And you're right.
It's a real stage.
If it's a hard room, it's a good show.
Hard room, good show. Yeah. I liked in that show. And then all of a sudden I was like, wait, what happened to those shows?
Yeah.
I heard you move back here.
Yeah. Vulcan was fun too. That was a fun room.
Yeah. Vulcan's still cool. Still, you know, it's sort of, Austin has this thing. It's like if you're part of the Rogan crew, it's a great place to be.
Yeah.
If you're not part of the Rogan crew, it's fine.
Exactly.
It's not the same, though.
I was connected. I was like a second cousin.
Yeah.
So it was, I knew them and they knew me and like Tony had done.
If Tony and Red Band love you, that's good enough.
Yeah.
If Rogan loves you, then
well,
just move
Rogan
Austin.
And I had been DMing about working together when I first moved there.
Oh, wow.
So I initially was like, asked him if, I was like, I'd love to work at your club. I've got a lot of experience. I'm very versatile in what I can do. Not just a restaurant guy, but I can produce shows. I know the industry. I can host them, you know. And then we kind of went back and forth about doing shows together when things were still kind of shut down there. And then things opened up and it was just like, crazy.
Yeah, yeah. So now when Rogan opens his club back up in Austin or opens the club up in Austin in the next, I'm assuming next few months.
Yeah, it's been pushed around.
Would that be something you'd want to go back for? Would that be something?
I pitched him and DM'd him. He left on red, so he knows.
Yeah.
He knows how to get a hold of me.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, you don't want to bug Rogan.
No, he's a little busy. So, and I know it's people that are running it. The staff. The thing is, I just want to get away from. See, comedy club is different from a bar.
You know?
Comedy club, people are there to laugh and have a good time.
Yeah.
I'm just sick of being in a bar watching people get drunk. So,
yeah, for sure. I get that 100%. Well, listen, man. So what are you up to right now? What do you got going on? What are you?
I'm at Robinson's Pub as a GM for another couple of days and I'm done.
Are there shows there too?
I was doing I had a Monday residency because it was, you know, I was running the club that we are going to have our last show this coming Monday.
Oh, wow.
And take a break. We don't know if we're going to come back yet. Shows have been awesome. Everyone loves the room.
It's
a great show. It's a great room. Anything I run, I put my heart into, so it runs right. But I actually have a Tuesday residency now at Bourbon Room in Hollywood, on Hollywood and Ivar.
Okay.
I just got pulled into that last week. A friend of mine found the room and then called me and said, I need you to help me run this room. So I started that. And then I'm just getting up now. I'm going to be in Vegas next week with Brett Ernst. I'm doing LA Comedy Club.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
You're featuring for him?
Feature open, I think.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And then I'm going to, I think, Jerome, Arizona right after that for a show. I don't know if I'm going to be on it, which is where Maynard has his, like, his little cult, his commune.
Yeah.
I'm going there. Like I said, I'm not sure if I'll be on that show. Dave Hill's performing as, like, a comedian musician. And then, I'm actually going to be in Chicago in July. I'm hosting for Rick Overton.
Nice.
At the Comedy Shrine, which is apparently like a 400-seat room.
Wow.
So I didn't know that. And that's in my hometown. That's in Naperville, Aurora. So
nice,
at a mall I used to hang out as a kid.
That's great.
So
that's beautiful.
I'm excited for that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then I've got some shows I'm picking up on between here and there. So.
Oh, very cool,
man.
Awesome. Well, you're always keeping busy. You always do cool things.
Yeah.
I could talk to you about a million different things, and I'm glad you came by, man.
Yeah,
it means
absolutely,
a lot.
Man.
Good to see you. Okay, so where can people find you on the social webs?
You can find me on all socials at the Trevor Kevelo, at Corrupted Comedy, and that's Corrupted with a K. That's Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram.
All right, guys. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.